ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass, live from Adelaide Oval, alongside Ed Cowan, the former Test opener, and of course my podcast co-host. After day one of the Adelaide Test match, the third Test in the series at Stumps, 8 for 326, the Australians winning the toss and batting. It was Alex Carey's day, who Stuart Broad once said, "That's all you'll be remembered for," after his stumping of Johnny Bairstow, and yet now there's another thing to add to his Ashes history. He's an Ashes centurion as the Aussies compile over 300 on the first day. First of all, Ed Cowan, great to see you. Wrap it all up for me. How should I feel about 8 for 326?
You should feel content on a few levels. And contentment should come in the form of knowing that that was a proper day's test cricket. We're back to some normality. I think if you're looking at the bell curve, we've seen some outlier days. That was smack bang in the middle for some cricket purists. And that doesn't mean there aren't narratives and great storylines to emerge. We'll unpick those. But it kind of warmed my heart a little bit to see, you know, England being able to stick to a plan for any more than 10 seconds, for Australia to bat properly for any more than 35 minutes. And at the end of the day, 8 for 320 is about right. It feels, I don't know what you thought live, coming through the broadcast, it felt like 350 was probably par, and it probably feels like it will be a par score.
It was a weird old day when you look at the scorecard. So 2 wickets fell on 33, 2 wickets fell on 94. There were 4 partnerships, 50 plus, none of them over 100. And so I don't know what that tells you. The other thing is when we look at the pitch, and you set this up beautifully for us on Monday, out of the 8 dismissals so far, 6 of them have been caught in front of the wicket. And the other one that was out caught was popped up off the glove of Weatherald and caught by the keeper. So it's not your standard, you know, nick into the cordon. The only catch that I thought went into the cordon was the one that was put down when Khawaja was on 5 by Brook at second slip. And just about every other nick fell short. And then Josh Inglis's dismissal is the only one I haven't mentioned, where he chopped on 32. What does that tell us about the motor dismissals?
Yeah, I think for common listeners of the pod, I think this will be pretty clear. I mean, the drop was that was a real flash. That was a Khawaja throw the kitchen sink at, and the ball, you know, flew to second slip where it then hit the turf. What we saw today was pretty much as predicted. Probably there's probably some nuance there that we can get into, but we saw 8 mils of grass. I thought they might have taken it back to 6, but it's a new type of grass that I know you've uncovered some secret goss from the groundsman earlier today. So a lot of grass, but not thick thatchy grass, just good old fashioned kind of Santa Ana grass. And so what that meant was it looked tennis ball-y. A little bit of moisture, so it swung early. It seemed a little bit early. England bowled poorly, and we'll come to that in the first 10 overs. They had a real opportunity to crack Australia open and kind of got lucky that they did. But it meant scoring was hard off the front foot. And so most of the run scoring today was either poor bowling and played off the back foot, or pie throwing off spin, and you could kind of pick where you wanted to hit the ball. And the rest, if you were to, I can't remember a drive down the ground. I didn't see every ball, you did. I struggled to remember a cover drive off the fast bowlers. And so if you got the ball fuller than you thought, and we're probably talking 3 meters from the stumps, usually falls kind of 4 meters. We're talking 3 meters, or not quite half volley, but fuller than full. It was hard to score. And when you did try and score, that tennis ball bounce caught people off guard, and we saw a lot of balls hit the inner half of the bat and, you know, twist in the hands and get caught in front of the wicket. And then conversely, when it was bowled short and fast, people got in trouble when they were trying to play horizontal bat shots, because the bounce wasn't that predictable in pace. You could kind of tell where the ball was going to come through, but you know, Archer got Weatherald with one that looked to skid through. It was quick and at the armpit, it was a good piece of bowling, but it kind of skidded through when everything else had kind of been a bit tennis ball-y. So yeah. I think batting will get easier tomorrow. I think there's no doubt about that, if England apply themselves. So batting's only easy if you bat properly. And so if they don't, there's a chance to get rolled, and Australia will go fuller than England. who went back of a length again. And I think the game's in the balance. So, you know, we'll see where this kind of falls. But we saw the ball turn and England didn't play a spinner. And I'm thinking, oh, Nathan Lyon will be licking his lips here.
And that's where I find the day so interesting to read. So you look at some of the modes of dismissal from the Australians and you think, gee, they've left a lot of runs out there. And yet they were so disciplined not to drive that you think, well, as if England's going to play that way. Hopefully they do for the sake of the contest, but certainly hasn't been how the series has panned out so far. The other thing Darren Lehman made mention of during the day to sort of back up what you've been saying, that in the Shield games here, a lot of the time the guys in the cordon stand with the helmets on. They're so close because, you know, so few of the balls actually carry to the cordon. So that was evident again today. Just on a little information from my man, Todd Heinrich, who's a listener of the podcast, long-time member of the Ground Staff here at Adelaide Oval, who I had a chat to him pre-play, Teddy, and I asked him sort of how accurate your analysis was as your horticulturalist hat on Monday talking about the square here. He did comment about the grass. He said, look, yeah, he's on the right track, but the grass has changed. So it's the Santa Ana grass now as opposed to the legend grass that it was in the past. I don't know if that means anything to you, Teddy, as the former cricketer. But
an opening batter, we knew our grass, Corb. And so the legend grass, a lot thicker, the leaf a lot thicker and more thatchy, and the Santa Ana is a finer kind of grain if you think of that. And so, you know, when you think about seam bowling, the ball catches in the thicker grass as opposed to the finer grass, which dies off a lot quicker as well. And so you kind of get that browner colour a lot quicker. And that's kind of how it played today. I thought we've been hard on Ben Stokes for most of this series. I thought he summed up conditions well with his strategy early on. You know, the third slip came out. They had their two catches, which ended up in wickets. They kept a mid-wicket, which, you know, is not a common position in Test cricket on day one, and particularly in Australia. And so he actually summed up conditions pretty well and probably at times kept England in the game because, you know, the cattle at times let them down. That opening spell was, you know, close to pathetic, I thought. And then, you know, at moments they kind of recaptured their ability to stay in the game. I mean, you called out two wickets on two separate scores. I think that suggests it's a harder wicket to score on. It's sometimes when batting's good and conditions are great, it's a, you know, 20 balls and you can feel comfortable. This is the kind of wicket you've got to be super sharp for your first 10 because the pace of the ball is so different to where they've come from, Perth and Brisbane, and also Brisbane, probably the Nets. You know, the Nets after a few days start playing like day three Nets and you get back on a day one pitch and you really got to check yourself again. And so all those little things played into wickets falling in clumps. I think if England had a bit more cattle with the ball and maybe a proper spinner, maybe Australia could have been all out under 300. I mean, they were 4 for 90. At 4 for 90, you're thinking they get to 250 here. You're a red hot chance.
Yep. The partnerships, Khawaja involved in 250 plus, Carey involved in 350 plus partnerships, batting with Khawaja himself, Inglis and Stark at different times. And yet, none of them went past 100. So England able to get the wicket at the right time and hang in the game. And for certain periods, it felt like they were the team on top. And a lot of our analysts in the broadcast were thinking that this could be, you know, 4-4-50. And the Australians are still batting at stumps. So we'll find out.
I didn't see it as a 450. I know you're live and probably seeing things a bit more up close. It never looked like 450 was the number.
We'll see, won't we? The Australians were disciplined not to hop on the front foot, and England maybe didn't allow them to, given that they bowled a little shorter than what they probably would have hoped at times. But it's fascinating the way that the test is placed at the end of the first day. The day's going to belong to Alex Carey. Rick Finlay provided the numbers on our broadcast. So a guy named Nip Pellew, NIPPELLEW, became the first South Australian to score 100 in Test cricket back in the 1920s. And since then, Pellew, Bradman, while playing for South Australia, Ian Chappell, Greg Blewett, Travis Head, and now Alex Carey. That's it. Wow. This has South Australians to score 100 on their home venue here at the Adelaide Oval. So Carey becomes just the sixth to do it.
And I assume Nip didn't keep wickets either. And so the first South Australian wicket keeper, I don't know, maybe you can check in on that. Yeah. My cricket history is good, but that's probably a little obtuse. Yeah. So, I mean, you don't need to get me going talking about Alex Carey, and these podcasts are meant to be shorter than our weekly, because I could take the next 15 minutes, you know, extolling the virtues of him as a cricketer, as a character, and what he does for this team. And today wrapped all of those three things into a bow for me. He played with discipline when he had to. He played with freedom when he could, all with that kind of stoic sense of, I'm going to hold this together for the team. And he did. Batting wasn't easy. This is a guy that his game has gone to a new level. We saw this last season, his attitude towards South Australian cricket, at times was, quite inspirational, really. He won them a shield almost single-handedly. And then to come to the Adelaide Oval for the first time to play a game since his dad passed away, probably only 4 months ago, would have been an emotional time for him. Mm. And he put that to one side and produced an innings for the ages. I think I said at the start of the series he was going to be either the man of the series or the key person for Australia. It's probably played out to be Mitch Stark to date, but I feel pretty good about being the president of the fan club.
Absolutely. It was a wonderful knock. He's such a likable guy. And I don't know, maybe for English cricket fans, it lives more in the memory of the incident at Lord's and everything else. And he was sort of this unusual villain where you would have thought out of anyone in the Australian team that would be casting that role, he's the least likely to do it. He's not a chirpy wicketkeeper.
He's wholesome. He's the anti-Australian wicketkeeper.
Yeah. Yep. And yet then he all of a sudden is in this very unfamiliar position. And with that as the backdrop, coming up against England, thinking, oh, what's the Barmy Army going to have for me this series? He's kept as well as he ever has. He's clearly the best clubman in the world. And his batting's never been better. This is the best he's looked with bat in hand. He's now up at number 6 in the lineup, batting ahead of Josh Inglis, which we've spoken about, and peels off 100 on his home deck. And the critical one in the context of the game, as you said, 4 for 90 when he walks out to bat. And in the end, when he got out, the score was 321 and Australia right in the contest.
Yeah, I mean, he'll go to bed tonight thinking, that was a bit of a miss, because with him in, Australia, could get 375 and push on. New ball, 2 overs later, I think there's a chance they get knocked over in a heartbeat in the morning and they're out bowling in the 39 degree heat. So batters are never happy. There'll be a nice glow to him tonight, but there'll be a nagging annoyance that he's not out and can push forward in the morning.
The day started with a whole lot of drama. We arrived at the ground and all of a sudden there were reports that, hey, Steve Smith might not play. And we're looking in the outfield, we think, well, there's Steve Smith. He's at the ground. So if he's got some kind of illness, surely he'd be back in the hotel. You think if he's here, surely he's going to play. And sure enough, as we got closer and closer to the toss, he was involved in a conversation with Pat Cummins and Andrew McDonald, his captain and his coach. And then Smith went into the dressing room, grabbed his bag, walked diagonally across the ground, as you have to do to get back to the team cars, and he was out of here. So he departed before the test had started. There were images of him lying down on his back in the nets, and we found out later that he's dealing with what he's being treated as an inner ear issue, which relates to nausea and dizziness, which probably explains a little bit as well why he was absent from the nets on Monday. And it's serious enough that Steve Smith, the man who loves cricket as much as anyone, is missing the test match here in Adelaide. It's thoughts with him firstly. Hopefully it's not as serious as he looks and he's okay. But, gee, that's a big blow to lose Steve Smith so close to the toss.
It is a big blow, and it kind of threw all kinds of planning, I imagine, out the window, and you just got to make do. And if Australia do go on to win this test match, without their best batter, it really says a lot about England and how they can respond, because this is a gift placed under a Christmas tree that England got to open early. Not in their wildest dreams would they thought Steve Smith wasn't going to play. But Australia, responded pretty well. So we hope he's okay. And it's not nice, that not knowing up from down and feeling sick and makes batting's hard enough. That would have that would have pained him. And you saw the footage of when he was talking to Cummins and McDonald. He wasn't happy not to be playing. It was, the body language read, I'll play. I'll get through it. I'm not at my best. I'm probably at 45%, but my 45% is better than the next guy. And so give me a go, Skip. And the skipper said, I'm not prepared to take that risk. I don't think he would have ruled himself out, put it that way.
Yeah. And that's, I think they probably made the right decision. We'll get to the knock-on effect in just a moment, but if he's dealing with that on Monday, it's now Wednesday, and he's still dealing with it, then you sort of think, well, that doesn't bode well to then play a potentially a 5-day test match and what turned out to be a batting day where all the batters had to get out there. So Uzi, who obviously we spoke so much about in the lead-up, and he's obviously dominated the headlines. He was left out of the original 11, so that in itself is worthy of discussion and something I didn't think that the selectors were going to do, and yet it felt like the right mix. And then, as happens in professional sports, something breaks your way, and a day shy of his 39th birthday, the door opens, he gets an opportunity, and then he plays an innings, which is almost his broader scenario in a nutshell. He gets a life on five. He looked all at sea for his first 30 balls and then was able to get into his groove and ultimately made 82. And then when he got out in the end, you felt like, caught slog sweep at deep square leg. You thought, gee, there was 100 that beckoned there for Usman Khawaja, and ultimately it didn't happen. Pick it up wherever you like. Yeah. But it's the curious case of Usman Khawaja. What do you make of it all?
I'm sure people are tuning in for this because in many ways, we've probably called balls and strikes when it's come to Usman's career, particularly in the last 2 years as a podcast, and you do your job as a brilliant independent broadcaster, and I have experienced what he's been through, and that is a declining skill base. So wrapping all that up, it's not to say that we don't want Usman to do well. When he got picked today, both you and I texted each other and said, let's go, boys. Like, go get him, son. And so, we were cheering him on because, at 39 this test, it's pretty amazing that he's still playing professional cricket, let alone test cricket. And I think there was a stat, if he did score 100, it would have been the oldest centurion in 100 years or something. So, it's a real outlier case. I thought they picked, so to go to the question, I thought they picked the right team. I think that's clear. We've made that clear for a while. The fact that he got to bat at four, I think, was a benefit for him. So there was a bit of a leg up to start with. I know he came in at 2 for 30, but every little bit helps. Archer with 6 under his belt, the ball a little bit softer. Batting at three is easier than one. Batting at four, you start getting exponentially easier than one. And so he benefited from that, but he played well. And their bowling, the wicket we've talked about, it was a back foot player's wicket. Guess what? This guy's a back foot player. And he's Australia's best player of spin. And so when Will Jacks comes and lobs a couple of, dollies up, he came down the wicket and smacked him over, extra cover a couple of times. He got to punch him off the back foot. He got to pull him. He'll probably be kicking himself that he didn't get a test 100, but who cares? The fact that he got opportunity and played as well as he did, I'm thrilled for him, and I'm sure there are many people around the country as well.
I've got so many questions going forward, and I'm sure we'll cover all those off, and maybe that's one for our Monday podcast as opposed to now after the innings. But you're right about the first sentiment where, it's a story as old as time, and my role as a sports commentator, this is basically what we do. It's storytelling. So it's, here's the guy who's missed out on the opportunity. The door opens again. He gets the chance, and then he takes his opportunity and he goes on and stars. And I know athletes can be sensitive at times. And Teddy, I always rib you about how it feels like cricketers more than most are sort of have rabbit ears and are attuned to what people are saying about them. But the guys write their own story every single time they get to walk out there, and really us in the press, we don't have any control over that. If the guy, looks like he's in decline, we say it. If he comes out and produces an amazing knock, we get to tell that story, which is equally as great. So that the guys get to write their own story every single time they walk out there, and we're just lucky enough to report on it from where we sit. And I know they feel sometimes like it's the world's coming at them a little bit harder than what it is, but that's certainly not the case. And I'm with you. You mentioned the historical context around it. So already just by reaching 50. He's the oldest to do that for Australia since Bob Simpson. And remember the circumstances around that in the late 70s in the World Series cricket days.
Yeah.
So 1978, the last time it had happened that someone that old, nearly 39, and he will be tomorrow with the temperature matching his age on the second day. Does it change the conversation going forward? That just give me a little insight. Is something different now moving to Melbourne on the back of what happened today?
I'll sleep on that, but my gut feeling says no.
Okay.
Let's see. Let's see where the test match ends up. If Australia win by heaps, if they lose, there's always questions. You know, Inglis, he'll come under pressure. You know, since his test debut, you wouldn't say he's set the house on fire. He's batting at 7. You know, 7's pretty close to 12. As a specialist batter, and so
it's closer than one, I guess. If you're looking at it numerically,
when you're going through teams and balance of teams, you see a specialist batter at 7. There's usually some red flags in there somewhere. So, look, he's going to have to get some runs, and he can write, as you just said, his own story. And you know, he's played well and got in twice and got himself out twice. So, let's just see where these cards fall for a little bit and make a call. With a bit more info.
102, duck, 5, 12, 23, 32. Yeah, so we spoke to him at Stumps tonight, and he said just that. Buff basically put it to him, is it a bit frustrating you got yourself in? And he basically said exactly that. It is frustrating. And today he chopped on, and I'm sure it's not a dismissal. He'd be all that happy with a start. And ultimately that was it, 32 for Inglis. Anything else of note before we get out of here, Teddy, that caught your attention after day one?
Record crowd for Adelaide Test match.
Yeah,
it's pretty amazing. I know we waxed lyrical about the Adelaide Oval. It looked like an AI-generated stadium this morning. It was picture perfect. There were, you know, I'm sure a lot of shivers running down spines when John Williamson sang True Blue.
Oh man,
and
that was unbelievable.
Yeah, I would have loved to have been there to experience it. So, all in all, we're in for a test match. If you've got day four tickets, hold on to them, folks.
It's well said. I mean, that was unbelievable pregame, and yeah, you could feel that. 56,298, so a record crowd in the redeveloped Adelaide Oval for a day's test cricket, and it's only day one. Who would you rather be when your head hits the pillow tonight? Would you rather be in Australia's position or England's position?
I'd rather be Australia. Because if I'm England, I'm thinking, as the wicket gets better, I don't know how I'm getting the next 10 wickets. Like, Australia won't make the same error twice. The batting, the ball will start skidding on a bit more as the grass settles down. And from what I've seen from their bowlers, my goodness, like I just don't know how they're going to take consistent wickets in that second innings. I think Australia's trump card in many ways, Nathan Lyon, but it's also England's joker. You know, there's a world where they really attack him and try and hit him out of the attack, and on a pretty good batting surface, if he's out of the attack and guys are bowling longer spells or having to come back sooner in 39-degree heat, you know, there's a chance that they can work their way back in the series tomorrow. But they need a 100-run lead.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating viewing. Can't wait for it. Of course, you can hear it all on ABC Radio and through the ABC Listen app. Teddy, you can catch this podcast after every day's play and every Monday and Friday right throughout the Ashes series. Thanks for your company. I will chat to you again tomorrow.
Loved it, Corb.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.